Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the organizers, Matt Fisher and the other organizers, for inviting me here and to show you something about carbon nanotubes, and hope to show you something on this very interesting molecules, and which is a very different system from the two-dimensional electron gases and still has a lot of interest in physics, which hopefully is also related to the stuff we're discussing here all week. Okay, so before I'll give my talk, I'd like to thank the people who collaborated with me on this. Some of the town's greatest students who did the main part of the transport experiment just left our lab. Lisbeth Venema, who's the greatest student doing the STM work. Jeroen Wilder and Alexa Besserudin, postdocs involved in the work. Michel Devoret, who's a visiting professor who spent a sabbatical in our group and got deeply involved in these experiments. And the group at Rice University, who provides the all the nanotubes which are indispensable for these experiments. The outline of my talk is denoted here. I'll assume that you do know a bit about nanotubes, but not too much, so I'll start with a fairly long introduction about the properties of these molecules, and then lead you through our Delft experiments on STM work, where we can resolve the atomic structure and do electronic spectroscopy, which will show you the gross electronic structure of these nanotubes, and some more recent experiments where we can map the one-dimensional wave functions of these nanotubes. And then in the second part of my talk, I will discuss electron transport experiments where we put nanotubes on metallic electrodes and do low-temperature transport experiments. So I'll discuss our first experiment showing the Coulomb blockade phenomena in these nanotubes, resonant tunneling through discrete states, and then I will try to present some more recent experiments on correlation effects on experiments where we have these two flying over multiple electrodes, and experiments where we build a single molecule transistor out of such molecules at room temperature. Anyway, that's a long program, so let's get started. I'm sure anybody of you is familiar with the buckyballs. What I would tell you now is about these nanotubes, who are basically part of this family of Fullerene molecules. And you can imagine such a nanotube as a sheet of graphite which is rolled up and which is capped by these Fullerene caps. So basically you can also imagine it as a C60 molecule which you cut into two halves. You add some hexagons here, you get a C70. You do that again, you get a C80, and if you do it a zillion times, you get such a nanotube molecule. These are the items that we discussed. And very briefly, they were discovered like 7 years ago in transition electron microscopy images by Iijima at NEC in Japan. And these are the original pictures from his paper reporting them. And basically what he saw in his FEM images is these coaxially oriented nanotubes, where you can see if you put a FEM beam through it, you see these kind of images where you see the walls of these nanotubes. And they have typical properties that they are very long, like a length of many microns, but their diameter is quite short, like only one to a couple of tens of nanometers. So they have a very high aspect ratio. They're really long, long wires. These are multi-wall wires where you have these multiple shells of carbon sheets. 2 years later, it was discovered that you could also make these nanotubes with only a single shell. And the real breakthrough came in 1995 when the Smalley group discovered that you could make these things at very high yields up to 80-90% or so. And that's really caused a flurry of experiments, of which I'm going to show you a number of experiments right now. These nanotubes are really have gotten a lot of interest, and the reason for that is that they're expected to really exhibit very interesting physical properties. And what it will tell you today is mainly something on the electrical properties, where you can use these tubes as quantum wires, but they have also very interesting mechanical properties and capillary properties. The mechanical properties, you can calculate that if you use them as a fiber, the tensile strength should be enormous. There have not been really experiments on that, but potentially that's a very interesting property for all kind of applications and also for fundamental studies of these molecules. What I can show you about the mechanical properties is something we intend to use in future experiments on the electrical properties, is that you can, in fact, take such a nanotube, and this is in fact a small rope of nanotubes, put your AFM tip here, and move it across, and you can manipulate the position of such a nanotube on a surface, in this case a silicon oxide surface. And you could do it again, put your AFM tip here, and you can put it there, you can do it again, and put it like here. So you can spell TU Delft in that way or whatever. But you can, more importantly, use that to manipulate the position of these tubes and do transport properties, and then you can look at the connection of mechanical and electrical properties. For instance, this is a real molecular property which you cannot...
How thick is that rope when you're moving around there?
Excuse me?
How thick is that rope?
I believe it's like 3 nanometers. We can do it with a single tube though, too also. Okay, on with the electronic properties. As I told you, you can imagine the buildup of such a nanotube from folding up a single sheet of graphite. And you can do that in various ways. Basically, you can take any point on the graphite lattice, take another point and define a vector there, and define two lines perpendicular to that, and take a scissors, you cut it out along these two lines, and you take the sheet, you fold it up like that, and then you can define a seamless cylinder of graphite. Right? Now you can do it along this direction, then you have a non-chiral nanotube, which conventionally is called a zigzag tube. Or you can define it under a vector of 30 degrees tilted. You get also a non-chiral tube, which is called the armchair. Or you can take any vector in between those two angles, and you end up with a chiral nanotube. So these are three varieties of carbon nanotubes. And now the special property of this thing is that these ones are predicted to be truly metallic quantum wires, whereas the zigzag or the chiral ones, most of them are semiconducting for various diameters and chiral angles, but some of them are quasi-metallic. And that's very strange if you think about it, because they're very similar. They're both carbon only, as a single sheet of carbon. Only the exact wrapping directions make up for the fact that it's a semiconductor or a metal. And if you think about it, that's a strange property which derives from the fact that graphite is a very special material. If you look at a single sheet of graphite, a graphene layer, it was already done in the 40s, some tight binding calculations which deflect the energy band structure quite well. This is the energy band structure in K-space, and you can see there's a conduction band and a valence band, and the valence band is completely filled up to these six singular points where the conduction and the valence band touch. Because of the symmetry of the hexagonal lattice, this is the way the energy bands look. So if you look at the top of this band, there's only the singular points at the corners of the first Riemann zone, which is completely filled. Right? So graphite is a very special material. Now what happens if you take such a graphite sheet and you break the symmetry of the graphite sheet by folding this sheet into a tube? What happens, of course, is that you have periodic boundary conditions if you go along the circumference of the tube. So you have only certain k values which are allowed. So if this is the tube axis, then the perpendicular direction, there's only k values allowed at these blue values in k-space. And now, if the special singular points lie exactly on the allowed k values, then there is a band which is crossing the Fermi level, and we have a true metal. And if not, if you take a slightly different axis direction for the folding of the graphite sheet, you can end up, for instance, in the zigzag nanotube configuration, that you have the situation that the allowed k-values are not crossing the singular points, but crossing rather some edge of the Brillouin zone where there's a gap. So then you have a semiconductor. Right? So we will focus a bit on... Oh, we'll have a look at the various nanotubes, but one of special interest is these armchair nanotubes, where you really have these two bands. So basically, these armchair nanotubes make up a quantum wire where you have two modes of propagation. One other thing I want to point out is that the next one-dimensional subbands are really very far away, electron volts away from the Fermi level. So this is really, compared to all the gallium arsenide work, this is high-energy physics, where we really have high energies involved with the quantum wire properties. So if these things exhibit quantum wire properties, they should exist up to very high temperatures. Although this is a heavily theory-dominated conference, I would like to have one sheet where you really see how you make this material. What Smalley coworkers do it. They take a graphite target with some metal particles for catalysts of these nanotubes, and they shoot with some sequence of laser pulses on the such a graphite target. And then there's an argon gas flow, and you collect some soot material on some collector, and then you take it out, you scrape it off. You have some black powder, some black soot, and that's the material which has a high abundance of nanotube material. I'm missing one sheet here. Sorry about that. Anyway, so this is a large entangled spaghetti material of tubes and ropes. In general, these tubes tend to align towards each other to make parallel bundles of nanotubes, ropes of nanotubes. And however, we put this soup material in some organic solvents, and then we've been able to find the deposition conditions for depositing this material on prepared electrodes on samples. So, for instance, we took some silicon oxide sample with platinum nanoelectrodes, and then you could find these locations where you have single ropes, or single bundles, or single tubes lying over these electrodes and do transport experiments. And I'm going to present you some of the transport experiments later. Right now, let me first show you the SDM results. So you do this in the same way. We take the soot material and some organic solvent. We ultrasonically shake this. We put some of this solvent in we put it on a gold 111 facet, and we dry up the solution, and we get some material where we can find these nanotubes lying on a gold substrate. So what you're looking at here is a nanotube lying on gold substrate, and if you take a height profile, you can see that the typical height of such a nanotube indeed is like 1.5 nanometer, a bit less. And that's consistent with transition electron microscopy. And so this is a single nanotube lying on this gold substrate. If you zoom in on this nanotube, we can obtain atomic resolution. We can obtain atomic resolution. This is an example of that. So all the black holes here are denoting the hexagons. So this is an image of a chiral nanotube where you can see the hexagon lattice winding its way along the two paths. So the two paths in this direction, the horizontal direction, and the black holes of the red dots, in fact, are denoting the hexagons winding its way along the two paths. If you look a bit in detail, in fact, there's still some questions about the exact identification of the atomic resolution. As I said, what we think is happening is that we see the centers of the hexagons. Basically, if you look in detail, if this is the center of such a hexagon, then we see only 3 out of the 6 carbon atoms in the hexagon surrounding that, which is a bit surprising. In graphite, that's oftenly observed. However, there the common knowledge is that it's because of different stacking of graphite layers. Here we have a single nanotube, and you would expect really to see all 6 carbon atoms. But many times we see only 3 out of 6 carbon atoms. We're sure that the tip electronic states are involved in that. And it's known from the graphite literature, for instance, that the apparent contrast that you can have on a graphite lattice can be very, very different depending on the exact tip states. And we think we see that also in our experiments. This is a side effect, but I just want to mention it, that there's some questions still in the atomic and the exact interpretation of the atomic contrast. The major point, however, is that we can use all these images to deduce, say, the chirality of this nanotube, whether it's a chiral tube or a non-chiral tube, etc. We can unambiguously define that, and it would be interesting to deduce this chiral indices to make a real identification of the nanotube. But that's on the borders of what we can experimentally do. What we see in the material from Smalley is that we have a large variety of chiral angles. So the blue lines denote the hexagon rows, and you can see that from this couple of examples here, that we find all kind of chiral angles in these nanotubes. So here's a histogram with some experimental results. You can see that we have all kind of chiral angles between 0 and 30 degrees. And we have a sort of peak distribution in the diameter. So all the tubes have a sort of diameter near 1.3, 1.4 nanometer, but the chiral angle is widely varying. And we use it to our advantage because we would like to... No, not that we could see. Minimum end?
Number of
rows. 8 armchair
or 10? Oh, no. The diameter in the arm. Well, we had only a few armchairs, so I cannot say really the statistics on that. But the general diameter distribution is very narrow. So our lowest tubes have a diameter of like one nanometer, which would be a, what is it, 8 tube or something. Yeah. It's fairly narrow distribution of the diameter, so then you would have if it would be armchair 9.9 or 10.10. Yeah. But the main message from from the picture I showed you is not armchair at all, and it is a really variety of chiral tubes in these nanotubes. So we have all these different tubes, and now the experiment that we've done is that we, not like in an atomic imaging experiment, put our feedback on and make images of this thing, but then go with the tip on the tube and put the feedback off. And do STM spectroscopy, so sweep the voltage on your STM tip and measure the current. And this is the result for that. So you basically have many IV curves where we just measure the tunnel current as a function of the applied bias, gives feedback shut off. And now in all these IV curves, you basically can deduce two classes of curves, one this class and another class like this. So on this class, we have a small slope here, and then some kink-like behavior, many kinks, and there's a rather small gap here where the kinks occur. The other class has no kinks up to an electron volt, doesn't mind an electron volt. A better way of showing this is to, of course, to take a derivative. And here you have the differential conductance, which should be a measure in a simple approximation for the density of states. And as I said, this is this first class of tubes where we see a gap of like 0.6 electron volts. And the second class of tubes has a gap of 1.8 volts. So all the chiral tubes have spectra which fall into these two classes. And this verifies this prediction which I told you earlier, that these nanotubes have either a semiconductor or a metallic character. And this class of tubes which has a gap of 0.6 electron volts are identifying the semiconducting tubes. Basically, for the semiconducting tubes, you expect the gap size, which only dependent on the overlap integral, the carbon-carbon spacing, and the diameter. So you have an inverse dependence on the diameter of the nanotube. And for this 1.4 nanometer diameter, you expect a 0.6 electron volt gap. And indeed, we have some coarse verification even of this diameter dependence of the gap size. So this sort of line is effective fit with an overlap integral of 2.7 electron volts, which is very close to the theoretical estimate of 2.5 electron volts. There's been similar work, by the way, by the Lieber group, who comes also to similar conclusions. Now, the second class is of tubes is denoting the metallic nanotubes. And obviously, if it's real metal, you don't have a gap. So what I call the gap there basically is the onset of the next one-dimensional subband. So in this case, this is the band structure. This is for a 5.5 tube, but it just exemplifies what I'd like to say. If you take the derivatives here, you have the density of states, of course. So there is a finite constant density state within this gap. And what I call the gap is really the onset of the next one-dimensional subbands. So at the top of this next one-dimensional subband, or the bottom of the one, you have this strong onset of in the density of states. And indeed, This distance between one-dimensional subbands, like 1.8 electron volts, quantitatively fits what you expect for this diameter tubes.
Do you see the sub-gap conductance?
Well, that's very hard to distinguish in our STM experiment, because that's near the noise level of the STM, and basically that's dependent on the set point of your tip with respect to the STM, to the tube. And if this feedback on, you select a certain set point. And then for that, you use a certain tunnel current, so it's hard to make a statement about that. It looks like it there, but it's on the border of the noise. So basically, you see this onset of next one-dimensional modes, and in the density state you see these peaks, and indeed we see these asymmetric peaks in the differential conductance as a function of bias. So these STM spectroscopy experiments quantitatively verify this central prediction of the nanotubes that they are metallic or semiconductor. One other interesting thing to note in these experiments is that there are some kind of displacements of the spectrums with respect to zero bias. And we think that's due to some doping of the nanotubes by lying then on the substrate. The nanotubes and the gold 111 substrate will have a different work function, so if you put these two together, there will be some charge transfer. Now, in the semiconducting tubes, really there's no states in the gap, so really the firm level is shifted towards the valence band edge, and then when it hits the valence band edge, there are electrons coming into the tube, changing the screening properties, and then pins the firm level at the valence band edge. In the metallic tubes, however, I mean, that does not occur. There is a certain shift, but there is a finite density state within the gap, and therefore the shift is much smaller in the Fermi position. Right. One other thing with STM, we can use it for atomic imaging, we can use it for spectroscopy, we can also use it for changing the nanotube properties, not properties, the nanotube layout basically, because what we can do is you can put our tip here in this image and pulse it. If you apply a pulse larger than 4 electron volts, apparently we can blow away locally the carbon-carbon bonds and make a hole here in the nanotube. So then we can confine the nanotube to a finite length. This length in this case is like 30 nanometers long. So we have reduced the nanotube, which first had the length of 3 microns, to a length of 30 nanometers only. And this, in this case, was an armchair metallic nanotube. And this shows you the IV curves, where we first had a linear IV curve on the long nanotube with no structure at low bias. And if you shorten the nanotube to 30 nanometers, you see these steps appearing there. And we think that's a quantum size effect. So it's just a quantum size effect of electron states in the length direction of the tube. So basically, you confine the electrons to the tube length, so you have only certain k values where it's allowed in the length direction, and therefore you have a certain energy level splitting in the dispersion, and which is about 50 millivolts, which indeed is the right order of magnitude in the IV curves. And more interestingly, recently we've seen it, if we measure these IV curves at various positions along the tube, there's new periodicity coming up which is different from the topography. So let me explain that to you. So this is a current voltage curve for this cut nanotube, and now we've taken these various current voltage curves along various positions along the tube. So it's one taken here, one taken here, one taken here, etc., going along the tube. So on some position, like the first position, you see this IV curve here. On the second position, the magnitude here is much increased. On the third position, it's lower again. On the fourth position, it's higher again, lower again, higher again. So we see a certain oscillation in the tunnel current. If I plot the tunnel current at this position in voltage, this is what you get. So this is the tunnel current, and you see a periodicity of about 0.4 nanometer, which is clearly different from the periodicity which you would expect from the atomic lattice, which is only 0.25 nanometers. To exemplify, to bring this out better, what I can also plot is, say, the IDV, the differential conductance, which will show a peak in between the transition between these two plateaus. Right? And this is done in this plot here. What you see then is that at a certain bias voltage, there's a step from the zero to a certain plateau. There's a peak in the IDV. This is plotting bias voltage here. So this is one IV curve. And then and what we then see, if we take these IV curves at various positions along the tube, there's a high differential conductance, low conductance, high conductance, low conductance. And the distance between these two points is, between these two points is again 0.4 nanometer. And doing this in this plot, we can directly see this periodicity in various discrete transitions, transition between discrete states. Basically, if you take a line scan through these points here, this is the more conventional way of plotting this, the differential conductance versus position along the tube axis. We see a periodicity here. The straight lines are the experimental results, and the dotted lines are a simple fit to a sine squared trial function, because what we think that what we're doing here is mapping out a one-dimensional wave function. So we have these quantized states, and we are taking these STM spectra, and that at these as these conditions where we can see the discrete states, we can measure on a single state and see this periodicity. So basically, the difference between two maxima, so not the adjacent but the next nearer neighbor maxima, is then a measure of the wavelength of the electron state for the standing wave. Yes? Oh, this is 4 Kelvin. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. And the level splitting is about 50 millivolts, so it's easily resolved. Yeah.
Does that coincide with expected wave vector for the...
Yes, that's right. Basically, what we see is a wavelength of like 0.7, 0.8 nanometers, and that's exactly the Fermi wavelength that you expect. Basically, you see even a subtle effect of the dispersion in here, because you see various states which have 0.76 and other states which have 0.67. And basically, this is the two Fermi points if we have doped the nanotube away from the crossing point in the band structure.
Do you see modulation?
No, I can't resolve that within the noise levels. I mean, this is the major thing we see. You're asking for some small modulation on top of this?
Yeah,
with the wavelength
twice the wavelength.
Yeah,
I think that should
be. Yeah. It's hard to tell. Okay. So there's some exciting results on the STM spectroscopy. Let me now move on to the transport experiments. Okay. Last year we started out, or maybe 2 years ago, we started out doing experiments where we deposited these tubes over metallic electrodes. So as I told you, we disperse these in an organic solvent. We make many electrode layouts on a single chip and select those where we have lying a single nanotube over electrodes. So I'm first going to show you some two-terminal experiments at millikelvin temperatures. And this is on this sample where we have, say, a tube which is in total length like 3 microns long, so it's extending its length way beyond the length scale of this picture. And the section between the two electrodes is like 140 nanometer. We typically have found always a very large contact resistance between the metallic electrode and the nanotube, for which we don't have a thorough understanding, but this is typically what you find for multiprobe experiments. The contact resistance is typically a megaohm or so, or half a megaohm, that order. Also note in this picture that there's a third terminal here, which we can use as a gate to electrostatically modulate the transport to the nanotube. This is a typical current voltage characteristic at millikelvin temperature, and there's two main features in this, which is the gap at zero bias and the step-like increase at higher bias. Currents are the order sub-nanoamp, and bias voltage of a few millivolts. We can display these current voltage curves also for different gate voltages, and this is what we've done here. So here we've scanned the gate voltage over a certain range. What you can see is that this gap in the IV curves can be increased to a maximum value, can be decreased completely, and increases again in a quasi-periodic fashion. These first samples had some meter stability, which doesn't make this a very nice pattern over many, many periods, but in general, this is the typical behavior that we see. So you can see that you can suppress the gap with a gate voltage, and the excited states are moving along with these edges. What you also can do is to reduce your bias voltage to, say, 10 microvolts, very low bias, and then scan your gate voltage continuously and get these peaks in conductance versus gate voltage. And as most of you are well aware, these are the typical phenomena for Coulomb charging, where you suppress the conduction at low bias if your capacitance of your object is a very, very tiny capacitance. So you have a finite Coulomb charging energy, and you have to supply some extra energy either by temperature or finite bias temperature, finite bias voltage to get the conductance finite again. What we also did is look at the temperature dependence in detail on one of those gauge scans. And from that, we can deduce important information. Here is such a result. So this is sweeping the gate voltage at a low bias voltage. And here we plot the conductance versus gate voltage in the regime up to 1 Kelvin. Now, the Coulomb charging energy, I forgot to mention it in the last sheet, is a couple of millivolts, like typical numbers, 3 millivolts or so. And that corresponds to a very large temperature for the Coulomb temperature, if you want to define a temperature, so like 30 kelvins or so, 50 kelvin. And so this temperature dependence in the range of sub 1 kelvin is a very low temperature. Right? Here we see a quite drastic temperature dependence, so the conductance is really decreasing quite drastically, and the gate lines are broadening quite drastically in this regime below 1 kelvin. And the solid lines are a fit to a model where you basically assume that the density of states of the nanotube that you probe is not continuous, but is consisting of discrete electron states. Right? So the model we have is that the tunnel electron through a tunnel barrier, which is representing the contact resistance, through some discrete electron state in the nanotube, through a contact resistance to the other electrode. And with the gate voltage, you're basically modulating your electrostatic potential such that your discrete transition between discrete states is exactly in line to get resonance tunneling between the two electrodes. So this is an important result because it shows you basically that there is no strong localization in this nanotube, because you can only have such kind of resonance tunneling if the wave function of the electrons on this tube are really extended at least over the distance between these two electrodes. If it would be a much smaller localization length, you would have very different phenomena. Right? So we are basically probing transport through a single molecular orbital, like in the STM experiments as well. We would like to measure the level separation between these discrete energy states, and basically for doing that, we move away from the regime of small bias, where we open up the bias window larger and larger, and that way get a higher tunnel probability because you have many more of these discrete states lying in your voltage window. And in doing so, you can get, say, a step-like increase of the conductance every time a new state enters your bias when you get a step-like increase of the tunnel current. And this is the experimental result. Right, so you see the step-like increase of the tunnel current if we now look at the current again versus gate voltage. It's a gate scan where we have increased the bias voltage now to 400 microvolt and up to 1.6 millivolt. And say from the typical width of such a plateau, we can then deduce the level separation, which in our case appears to be half a millivolt. Well, that's an important number because if you take the most naive estimate for single particle states in a box of a certain length, this is what we get. So we assume that this is a quantum size effect, and that we just have a quantization of momentum in the length direction of the tube. We get a certain allowed k values in that direction. And then we plug that into the linear dispersion relation for carbon nanotube, which is a very rigid result. And near the Fermi level, it's a linear dispersion relation. We know the Fermi velocity from the band circuit calculations. So there's basically only one free parameter to choose, and that's the length of the box. So for the level splitting energy, we find something like half a millivolt, right? And that fits nicely with the measured half a millivolt in our experiment. And the important thing to note here is that we've put in the total length of the nanotube. If you would confine, say, the resonant tunneling only through an island between the two electrodes, you would have 140 nanometer, which is a factor of 20 off. So this number would be like 20 millivolt, 10 millivolts or so, which is completely inconsistent with this experiment. So this suggests that this indicates that the wave function is really extended over the whole nanotube of 3 microns long, and we're probing resonant tunneling through all the adjacent states in the nanotube. Sure. It's including the spin degeneracy, and it's taking the levels degenerate. That's a choice. But that's, as you say, it's a factor of 2 which you are off then. It's an order of magnitude comparison anyway, I would say. The Coulomb kinetic energy is like 2.5 millivolts for this specific nanotube, and that fits well with a sort of rough calculation of the capacitance which you would make. It, Excuse me? Oh, the question is what is being charged in this Colombo cake? The physical picture, I'm sorry if that didn't come over, thanks for the question, is that we put electrons from the electrode on the tube and back to the other electrode. So what's charged is the nanotube molecule. Other questions? More recently, we've done some more detailed spectroscopy, electron spectroscopy at millikelvin temperatures on a sample which is particularly stable, and we found some surprising results. This is a conductance spectrum where we've plotted the bias voltage and the gate voltage on the vertical and horizontal axis, and we've plotted the differential conductance in a color scale. So blue here is denoting the regions where there's no current, no conductance, and red is the regions of a high differential conductance. To appreciate this plot, so what you see here is the blue regions. Yes. High conductance is a high differential conductance. Oh, the exact number. It's well, typically lower than the full conductance quantum, like by a factor of 10 or 20 or so. Okay. Okay, let me explain this plot to you. The blue regions are the Coulomb blockade regions, so the gate scans I showed you before is at, say, a near zero bias, so there's a peak here, 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 etc. Now, if you apply higher bias, you have a larger window where you have current running through your device. And to appreciate what is special in this plot, maybe it's good to first show you what you expect for a very simple quantum dot. There's nothing special. Basically, you have a quantum dot with discrete states. What you expect is that the energy goes quadratically for a state with n electrons as a function of the gate voltage. Right? So if you want to make a transition between n and n plus 1 electrons on a quantum dot, you have to increase your gate voltage so that you're exactly in line at the point where you can make a transition. Or you can go to another gate voltage, but then you have to supply a certain bias voltage to overcome the Coulomb blockade. And in this way, you can get a conductance spectrum which looks like this diamond-shaped Coulomb regions, and you have excited states at higher bias. So if you want to go from the n to n plus 1 electron state, you can either go from here to here with a bias voltage, or you can get an even larger bias that can also excite the excited state of the n plus 1 electron system. So you have these Coulomb diamonds. Now, the special features in this nanotube, there's many things which deviate from this simple model. There's many complicated structure in the excited states at high bias, but even at the lowest bias, we see really very weird phenomena like these kinks in these diamonds. And basically, if you look in detail, you see these kinks and bands everywhere in these diamonds. And we think we can, at least phenomenologically, explain these kinks in these Coulomb diamonds by proposing that the capacitance of the nanotube will depend on the quantum many-body state of the nanotube. Because if that happens, then it means that basically that the excited state parabola in this plot for the energy versus gate voltage is not really on top of the ground state parabola. Because the functional dependence of the energy on gate voltage is denoted like this. So if the capacitance between the gate electrode and your nanotube molecules, depending on the quantum state, it means that the excited state is not lying here anymore, but can be shifted. And if that occurs, then you can have, say, a sort of transition between the n-electron system of a quantum state with n electrons and another quantum state with n electrons, right? So it's not a transition where you will have a current at low bias running, because it's not a transition where the electron number on the dot is changing. But it's sort of what we call an internal transition, where the quantum state of the n-electron system then is changing. So why could the capacitance depend on the quantum state? This is, of course, a strange thing. But you have to realize we're not talking about a large metallic object where all the electric fields are screened. We're talking about a molecular system where, for instance, the effectiveness of screening could depend on the exact quantum state that you're looking at. Anyway, so if you do this, if you make this assumption, then indeed you can get these kinks in these diamonds. So that's one of the observations that we can explain with this model. There's one very odd phenomenon that we observe in this experiment, and that's the following. Basically, we've done gate scans here as a function of magnetic field for this particular device. And what you can see is if the Coulomb peaks now as a function of magnetic field, how they evolve. And what you see here is lines in two directions. So lines going up in slope and other slopes going down, and all these slopes have more or less the same value. And this is reasonable because earlier on we also seen that basically what you see in a magnetic field on these Coulomb peaks is only the Zeeman effect. So you have spin up states and spin down states, and they will move differently in a field. And so you can say if you have such a transition, if you apply a field, there will be a shift in the energy of the state because of the Zeeman effect. So you have to tune away your gate voltage to get the resonance again. So the lines will move either down or up. Well, this reasoning is pretty thorough, and there's not much you can change about that. And what you see here is then the odd phenomenon that all these Coulomb peaks move down in energy with increasing field. So this means there must be some kind of spin polarization because all the electrons enter the nanotube apparently at the same spin. Because up to 1.5 tesla, what we see is that all the Coulomb peaks move down in energy. All of them, in all the adjacent Coulomb peaks. So all the electrons entering the spin, next one and next one and next one, have the same spin. And that's a very odd thing. Because if you would have a simple level filling of states, you would expect, for instance, if you have degenerate states for these two bands, you would expect two spins up, two spins down, two spins up, two spins down. So you would expect that these transitions go up in pairs or go down in pairs, or go up in pairs, etc. That's not what's happening. What's happening is apparently we sometimes fill this state not with an electron down, but with an electron up. Right? So we have to conclude from the experiments that there's some kind of spin polarization in nanotubes.
This is one sample.
This is one sample, the most stable sample. And the other samples, there was too much, offset charging of the samples where we could not do this detailed spectroscopy. So we could do this detailed spectroscopy only on our best sample. That's right. So we have to do more samples to certify it again. But yeah, this is the best sample that we have. One other thing. How much time do I have?
7 minutes.
Okay. I'll let you do it a bit quick then. What we could also do is to have a look at these... at one of these peaks, in particular this one, we go down, up, down, up, and now get a larger bias window. So we can see the excited state spectrum now in this magnetic field dependence of the gate scan. And this is the plot you get, so you recognize this down, up behavior. And now we've widened up the bias window, so we have more transitions in within our voltage window. There's a number of observations here is that the width of this stripe is smaller here than the width of this stripe, which may seem like a detail you, but we take that seriously. One other thing is that the transition line between this kink and this kink is not vertical, which means that the transition between, say, this state here and this state occurs at a different magnetic field at this point and at this point, which also is an odd phenomenon which you don't see in typical quantum dot spectra. One other thing is that you see all kind of lines here in this spectrum, but we cannot trace that back in the addition spectrum. So it looks like the excited state spectrum is really scrambled with respect to the addition spectrum for electrons. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so there's no current running here. If there's a yellow line, there's an electron coming into the nanotube. If there's a blue line, there's an electron. There's an excited state where, in fact, there's an electron vanishing from the tube, etc. So you're looking basically at the spectrum. Where is it? Here? No. Yeah. That's right, yes. That's correct, yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so we see all kind of, a complicated excitation spectrum. The point I'm trying to make is, let's forget about the excitation spectrum. If you look at it in detail, we see it's different from the addition spectrum, but that's not so important point. Let's look at this line here. What we think is happening here is that if the increase in magnetic field, the spin state of the nanotube is changing. Which is not so odd, which is what you commonly see if you make a larger and larger field. You can align spins, for instance, right, in a quantum dot. However, this line is not vertical. It means that you also cross the same transition line by changing your gate voltage, which is kind of odd, because it means that you can change apparently the spin state of the nanotube by changing your gate voltage. It's a sort of new phenomenon, because we haven't seen that before. And that's consistent with what I've shown you before on these excited states which have parabola of energy versus gate voltage, which are displaced with respect to each other. For instance, we have let me quote you one example. This is an electron system which is a doublet state, right? And for the n plus one electron system, we could have a triplet state or a singlet state, right? It's like the green and the purple curve here. So suppose for this situation here, for this field here, we have a transition from the doublet state to the green lines here, which is the singlet state. Now, in a magnetic field, these states change differently. They evolve differently with magnetic field because the triplet state, of course, moves down very quickly because it has a large spin. But the singlet state does not move, right? So the relative location of these parabolas is displaced vertically. Is moving down here. Nice timing, yes. And what you see here is a number of things. Now, so we've changed the situation from a doublet to the singlet state, from a doublet to triplet state. So we can change the spin state by a magnetic field, and we can also do that by the gate voltage, like in the curves I've shown you a little bit before. So let me just very quickly summarize some of these observations. Right. Maybe the main odd phenomenon that we observed is that all the electrons entering the spin at low field have the same spin. We didn't mention that. We don't see that the Zeeman splitting starting at zero field. We see that the excited state spectrum is different than the addition spectrum. And we induce that the gate voltage can induce spin flips. And we cannot reconcile all these phenomena with simple single particle models and level filling schemes and so. So we conclude that there must be some reason lying in the electric correlations driving these phenomena. Must mention also that the Mihun group has recently obtained data on ropes of nanotubes which are not consistent with the results. They see some simple spin splitting, odd even phenomena. And there's no clarity right now what is the difference between these two types of experiments. They measure on ropes, we use single tubes. That might be a clue because the screening might be different in ropes. But I think we really have to do more experiments to solve this divergence of results. Okay, in the last 5 minutes or so, let me then tell you a bit about two different experiments that we've done. One is on one class of experiments where we looked at nanotubes which are contacted by many, many electrodes. And this gives you an interesting possibility for experiments as well, because you're now going to, for instance, compare two probe measurements on this pair and this pair and this pair, or do four terminal measurements where you can try to exclude the contact resistance. So here's a number of results on this samples. One again is that we find a contact resistance of about 1 to 4 megohms, varying from contact to contact. However, the four probe resistance between various pairs, between various sections in the center part of this four terminal resistance, is always about 90 kilo in this specific samples, which is remarkable. This is room temperature measurement. Another thing is at low temperature, I'll discuss it in a minute. At low temperature, what we find is, again, this is 4 Kelvin, so Coulomb scan. So this is current again versus gate voltage. So this is the Coulomb blockade scans, right? What you see is for the various pairs, so 1 to 3, so excuse me, one between electrode 1 and 2, or electrode 2 and 3, or electrode 3 and 4, you see very similar Coulomb blockade signatures, but they're not exactly the same. And that's an important point, because it shows you basically that in this case, the nanotube is not one quantum island, which is just contacted by probed at various positions. But basically, it looks like this tube is broken up into a string of quantum wires in series, where you contact a different section of the tube with different electrodes. And one other thing is, for instance, if you measure them not between adjacent electrodes, between, say, 1 and 3, then you basically get the series addition of these 2, 3, and 1, 2. Because you get a peak only when there's a current between 1 and 2 and 2 and 3, but no peak, really, when one of the islands is blocked. As I said, there's other experiments you can do as well between with these kind of samples. You can, for instance, compare the 2-probe and 4-probe transport at somewhat elevated temperatures, where, say, in 4-probe measurements, you don't really get. I mean the 4-probe. This is done at 20 Kelvin. Okay, so what you see here is if you would do this in the Coulomb blockade, you would have blockade at a certain position, so you couldn't do the 4-terminal measurement. So what we've done is at 20 Kelvin, compared the 2-probe and the 4-probe, and it was quality of resistance versus gate voltage, basically the inverse of the current, right? So what you see here is a contact resistance, a constant contact resistance, and you see some all kind of wiggles, which are the same for the 2-probe and the 4-probe experiments, showing you the residue from the Coulomb blockade scan. So basically, also the 4-probe experiments show you that we have Coulomb blockade, and that proves basically that in a 4-probe experiment, we also have some Coulomb island between two adjacent electrons. Well, there's other things about the temperature dependence which come to the same conclusion, and the conclusion that this leads to is this. Basically, that in general we have two types of arrangements that we find for these nanotubes lying on electrodes. The one I just showed you, we deduced from our experiments that we have 1, 2, 3, 4 of these barriers, or 1, 2, 3 islands between two adjacent electrodes, two made up of the contact resistance to the nanotube, and also two extra barriers in between adjacent electrodes. And so we have a sort of, if we measure between adjacent electrodes, then we measure on a sort of multiple quantum dot system. So the whole nanotube is broken up in a number of quantum wires in series. However, we also have these other wires which appear to behave like one coherent quantum wire, which I shown you in the first example of these Millikelvin experiments on these extended states. We think that the difference between the two might be in the chirality of the nanotube. That's a speculation that needs some theoretical backup. But we think that, say, the bending of the nanotube near the edge of the electrode might induce a barrier for electron transport, and that might be different from the armchair tubes, which, because the higher symmetry, might be more robust against such action than the chiral tubes.
You don't have a direct measure of the chirality of
these tubes. No, we don't. In these experiments, we don't have measured the. We didn't measure the chirality.
What is the
Okay. What I can say from the experiments is that we encounter tubes, some tubes which do break into a string of quantum wires, and other tubes we do, which don't.
In a very similar
structure. So experimentally, we cannot see a difference, only in the properties of the tubes. So we speculate that this may be due to the bending properties near these edges. But there may be different explanations as well. But we deduce from the experiment that some behave like one quantum wire and some break into islands, where one island is on top of the electrode and another island is between the electrodes.
Why the barrier should be necessary to loss of coherence? You can imagine that you have including the barrier.
So you could have resonant tunneling through all three.
Yes.
The question is, can you have coherent transport through such a multiple island geometry of an nanotube on electrodes? Well, maybe it's possible, but I mean I don't want to make a statement about the coherence, but what we see is that we have, say, these multiple islands in series. I mean,
you have additivity of the resistance.
That's one thing at room temperature, but even at 4 Kelvin in the Coulomb blockade, but you also have, say, the temperature dependence, which is really very drastic, like a factor of 50 going up to 80 Kelvin, which is very different in the top case, where we have only a factor of 2 or so increase because of the Colombo plate. So.
But at room temperature, they look the same. You always get this 90 kilo ohm resistance.
No, and that's a good point. Yeah, and basically, in a four terminal measurement in room temperature on such a device, I would expect. Yeah, that's a good question. What to expect, really? But you could, for instance, imagine that if it would be ballistic wires at room temperature, you would have no voltage drop, right?
But what you see.
What we see is that the samples on many terminals are quite rare, and so we see these ones we see more often than these ones. And so we have some samples in four terminal geometry which give a typical resistance of say 100 kilo ohm or so, and other ones which have a lower resistance like 10 kilo ohms in four terminal at room temperature.
And when you cool them down, do they one shows the Coulomb blockade peaks and the other doesn't?
All samples show the Coulomb blockade peaks, but you mean the ones showing the multiple?
Yeah.
It I really have too little statistics to make a well grounded statement on it. I mean, you have in total like 10 samples or so giving on it. We don't do that. We have done that, but there's this little success because typically our samples, our single tubes do not survive that. And because what I've shown you with the SCM, remember that with 5 electron volt electrons, you blow away the carbon-carbon bonds.
So
I think that's what's happening there too.
Maybe we'll get some more questions after the talk.
I have, let me just in 3 sheets show you this, a bit out of context for most of this audience, but of some interest anyway. You can also do the same thing, so put nanotubes on electrodes and use the silicon as a gate. And now, what I've told you up to now is all transport experiments on metallic tubes. Right? If we measured on semiconducting tubes, we see a clear field effect action. So we can make a transistor out of this nanotube assembly, which even works at room temperature. So the metallic tubes have a resistance which is not modulated by a gate voltage at room temperature. But in the semiconducting tubes, so typically you would find this green nonlinear IV curve. Look at the scale here now. We are looking at bias voltage of a volt now over this assembly and still nanoamp currents. So we have some nonlinear IV curve, and we can basically make that into a metallic response by applying a negative gate voltage. And we can suppress the conductance at low bias very, very much by putting a positive voltage on the gate. So we have a clear gate action, field effect action, where we can change the conductance at low bias by 6 orders of magnitude with a gate voltage of 10 volts or so. So that's an interesting effect. And we have been thinking in modeling this field effect action with a model which we sort of borrow from old silicon devices, which is called the Barrett device, where you have a small piece of semiconductor in between two pieces of metal. And the idea of what we have on what's happening in these devices is that the Fermi level is pinned to the valence band edge of the nanotube. So this is a semiconductor nanotube. There's a gap, but the valence band edge is aligned with the metal of your electrode, and then the field will have an effect on the bands in the piece between the two electrodes. So with a positive gate voltage, you deplete holes there, and with a negative gate voltage the other way around. So you can change the amount of bending between the two electrodes. And then if you apply a bias, you can inject holes, because we have hole transport in these devices between the source and the drain. So you can try to model it along these lines. So I will just, in due time, put up my conclusions and... Well, I'll leave it with that, but I will hope that I've shown you that these nanotubes are really a very interesting new class of materials which behave like quantum wires at the molecular level. Thank you very much. Question is, what is the contact resistance between two nanotubes crossing each other? I don't know yet. It's easy, right?
Is there an idea by the temperature dependence of the four terminal resistance, whether
Question is, what can you say about the temperature dependence of the resistance? Is there any twistons or phonons or electron correlation effect? Well, we have data. I mean, we have some data on ropes, on single tubes, four terminal and two terminal, and you see the quality of the data is not really good. Typically what we see is that the resistance increases if you cool the sample to low temperatures. I think the quality, the statement should be that the quality of the data is not good enough to really make a statement on what's happening. No, resistance goes up as you increase temperature, right? Resistance goes up if you decrease the temperature. We have some data on ropes where the resistance goes down if you decrease the temperature. So the reverse trend. And I mean, what you could do, I mean, the next speaker will talk about that, is to do some power law IV curves on the resistance versus temperature. We have some data on that, but our data is really not good enough to make a statement on that. Well, it could be that they're ferromagnetic. But I've shown you one scenario, I've tried to show you one scenario where we can see that there are spin-lowering transitions, internal transitions in changing the gate voltage, which would mean that you don't need to have to invoke a macroscopic polarization of the spin in the nanotube. So you could have some sequences where you lower the spin by some internal transition between two adjacent Coulomb peaks. I skipped that part because of the time, but that's a scenario that we think is more likely.
Cannot be the
I mean, it's a puzzle why we see this spin alignment, and I don't know at this point. It's open for the future.
Sure.